Hi, this is an interview with Sam Weldon on October 8th, 2007, Studio X, Campbell Hall, Urbana. The videographer is Jack Mark, and I'm Nancy Rotzel. Okay, Sam, now you get to tell us where you're from.
I was born in Champaign County in 1925.
And how in the world did you end up in World War II?
Well, one day I was walking down on West Church Street by my church, and it was a late winter day. I was going to the U of I, and I walked down to the Springer Building, which was our post office, and there was a sign, and it was blowing. And it says, there was a picture of a guy, says, "I need you." And then the next sign was a picture of a Marine on a desert island with three beautiful ladies. And I thought, that's for me.
And how old were you at that point?
18.
So you enlisted or you were drafted?
I was drafted. I wanted to go in, but my father had a friend on the draft board. When I was 18 in October, he says, "Tell him to stay in school because he's going to be gone by the last part of December." So rather than to have family argument, I stayed. But then when I got up in Chicago, where they gave you the exam, you had to ask for it. And it got so bad later on, they just grabbed anybody. They couldn't get enough men, you know.
So you asked for a particular...
Yes.
Part of the service.
Which line is the Marine line? Sergeant there. Right there, son.
Okay, so you went in 23. No.
Pardon?
What year did you go in?
The exam was in December of 1943.
Okay.
And then they sent you back home and called you back. And you got on a train and shipped to California, troop train. And it was a regular passenger train. You had a nice bunk. It was sort of interesting. I'd never been on a long distance train like that. But I found out later there's a lot longer places than that.
So when did you decide which service you went in?
That was when
Chicago or...
Yeah, I didn't, up there, yes, I wanted to go in, but I just couldn't get in because of my father. But that's neither there. So I got up there and I volunteered, took the exam, physical, and then they sent us back home. And then we had to be in Chicago they send you your ticket. You had to be there a certain day, and we boarded a troop train. Took you all the way to San Diego. And I think that was... 3 nights and 2 days. It was a long trip. It was on a sleeper, though. It was nice. They treated you right. They fed you well. When we got into San Diego, they backed the train into the Marine Corps base. And here's a bunch of guys, civilians, no idea. And the man in charge of us is a sergeant, and they woke him up. That wasn't very good. You got in there at 4 o'clock. And you got up at 5 o'clock, 1 hour sleep. And then you have to take all these tests, and you have to see a dentist, and you have to see a doctor, and they give you all your clothes and cut your hair off. It was quite a busy time.
And is that where you had training?
Yeah, that was the Marine Corps training was 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. But because of the need for Marines out in the Pacific, they cut it down to 8 weeks. And then after you had your 8 weeks, you might have got a chance to go home for a short period of time or go get some advanced training. So my next training place was north a little ways of San Diego. It's called Camp Elliott. But when we get up there, we found out that the Navy was taking over the base, and they didn't want us around. So they said, call home and get some money and go back to Champaign. And so I did. And then when I come back, we moved from Camp Elliott up to the Camp Pendleton, a monstrosity Marine camp. You could take Chinook Field 20 times and put it miles and miles, and they got mountains, and they got training camps, and they got airstrips, and that is the number one Marine Corps base on the West Coast there. And we had, so when we got there, this was wartime. Here was our tents all set up, and there was dust on the floor that deep. And so you had to walk through the dust and put your sea bag, you keep all your clothes around there. And I looked around and I asked a sergeant, where do you get your water? You get your water right up there on top of the mountain. And how do you get water from the mountain? He says, that's melted canyon water. So when you took a shower, you pulled a cord and this melted canyon water come down and stepped out and soaked up and then jumped. Hey, everybody screamed. It was cold. Oh, it was the coldest water I've ever had. So we stayed there for 8 weeks. And then they shipped us out. We went down to Long Beach, picked up a troop ship, and went to Pearl Harbor. And we landed in Pearl Harbor, and some trucks arrived and took us place called the Transit Center. Little did I know what it meant. Everybody that they needed, that was a melting pot. So every division that wanted men, they put a request into the transit. I think I was there a week or 10 days. And they put us on a real small ship, and they had no idea where we're going. It was called a landing craft empty. And I got out, and I could look around, and I could see almost all the Hawaiian Islands. Miles and miles away, and they pulled in, and this was Maui, and the Marine camp in Maui was located up at the top of a plateau where it had a volcano that was inactive, and you had a lot of nice tents, a lot of nice cold water, mm-hmm. and you had dehydrated potatoes, you had powdered milk. But you were a Marine, and you're in the infantry, and that's the way it was, and you couldn't do anything about it.
Okay. So how long were you there?
Well, I got there in June of 1945, and I was there June, July, October, November, December. And in December, they told us we were shipping out. And we closed all our tents up and rolled all our, we had cots we slept on, folded all the cots. And they said that we eat early breakfast, and 2 o'clock in the morning, trucks are going to come and get you. So we shipped out. The trucks came and got us at 2 o'clock in the morning. We got down to the dock, and we waited until 11 o'clock in the morning for the ship to show up, the troop ship. And when the troop ship showed up, the young man who tried to dock, there's a very small dock in Maui, he couldn't dock the ship. So they had to go find an Hawaiian who was a harbor master, could park this troop ship without tearing it up. So I think we got over to Maui, Pearl Harbor about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We got up at 2 o'clock, took all that time to get over there. There's always some snafus. And then we got off that troop ship, and we got on an LST. There was a whole fleet of LSTs. They're about, this little cargo ship, about as big as a football field. And every company was assigned a ship. And while we were there, they were working on some of these ships, and somebody was working on a ship with dynamite and with a torch. And we heard a big explosion, and we looked down, and here's a lot of Marines diving in the water. The ship was on fire. So they had to go. Before we shipped out, they had to get another ship because it had a fire and it wasn't seaworthy.
Right.
So we took off, and these LSTs, the speed of an LST is about 3 or 4 miles an hour. We had 250 Marines. We had the officers and the crew of the LST was all in it. So we started way ahead of any of the other Marines in the Pacific because we couldn't make any time. We were escorted with out to mid-Pacific, and we were guarded with destroyers and destroyer escorts. We never saw any submarines. And finally, some other ones, Marines, joined us that we pulled into the Marshall Islands. Most beautiful water you ever want to see. Gorgeous. And they put the front of the ramp down in the LST and let all the men have a swim. No bathing suits. And that was, for some of those men, that was their last swim because they didn't make it through the battle. So after we got our swim, we went down to the Mariana Islands. It was called Saipan. And we anchored in Saipan, and we lost our places to sleep. Some marine amphibious tanks that would take us into the battle, they backed them up in there. So from, I guess, 3 or 4 days, we had to sleep on the metal deck. There was no place else to sleep.
Right, and you were headed for a battle where?
Pardon?
Where was the battle going to be?
Well, after we left the Marianas, that was Saipan, about 3 or 4 days, one morning I could hear a bunch of explosions, and I woke up at 2 in the morning. And when it began to get light, I looked out, and I couldn't believe what I saw. And I called my friend. I woke him up. There was 800 or 1,000 Army vessels, battleships and cruisers and gunboats, and they were all shooting. They had been shelling this island for maybe 72 hours, and they had been bombing the island for maybe the Air Force had been bombing, Air Corps, been bombing the island for maybe 72 days. But unfortunately, we didn't know it, and the intelligence didn't know it, but the Japanese had tunneled the island. There was about 10 miles of tunnels and caves. And the general was on the Japanese general, had made up his mind that in all the previous battles with the Americans, that they mention at the, when you get out of your boat, they mention it right away with shells and artillery. He was going to let them in. So he let the first wave in, come in, and they had all their weapons were preset. All they had to do is set the mortars, fire the artillery. So we get in there, and the first wave, we can hear the radio coming. Very light resistance, and that didn't sound right to me or any of the other guys. So this amphibious tank took us down the beach about 30 yards, dropped the ramp in the back. We ran around both sides, and I guess we ran 15 yards, and then, boom, the first shell hit. Well, all I can remember is I'm going up in the air, and a terrible pain in my ear, the concussion off of the shell, and I got up and off my hands and knees like somebody hit me in the jaw. And I saw my friend, and there was my best friend laying there. So we went over to him. I couldn't see any wound. I couldn't see any blood. And then about the time I was going to roll him over, a beachmaster who was a major, get off the beach, get off the beach, get up. They'll kill you here. Get in there underneath the shell. So we took his weapon. He had a mortar on him. And I grabbed a friend of mine who was a cook. But the cooks became ammunition carrier in battle. So we ran up away, and I found a great big shell hole. And I said, in here. And we drove down in that shell hole. The beginning, the first days in the battle, everything doesn't go right. It's not like a basketball or a football game. Everything goes wrong. So we got in this hole, and we faced what we thought was the front line. And pretty soon, within an hour or two, here come our tanks. And there was a brave Marine leading the tanks. He was guiding each tank this way and that way and that, because there are all these shell holes, see? Once they get in, the tank gets in the shell hole, he's done. He can't get out. So pretty soon, the first tank must have hit a place where they couldn't go any further. And here's this line of tanks, And pretty soon the Japanese began to, when they shoot the tanks, they knock one tank, two tanks, three tanks. And I mean, just blew them up, see? And we're down in this hole like this. And everything that's missing the tank is going over to the other side of the hole. And I shake my friend. Look at this. Steel was just raining in this volcanic ash. You couldn't believe. Hey, he looked and he went like this. And you try to dig yourself a hole. You can't. You can't go any deeper. And pretty soon a young fellow jumps in. After the shelling stopped briefly, he says, "You got to help me." I said, "What's the matter?" He says, "I got my lieutenant. He's wounded badly in a tank and I can't get him out." I said, "Look, go down to the beach and get yourself a couple of corpsmen." I said, "We got chewed out for trying to help my friend." So he took off, and I don't know whatever happened. Then pretty soon we're laying there, and some of the shelling stops. This begins at mid-afternoon. We go in at 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and I see these bullets going, or tracer bullets, every so often. This tells whoever's firing it, where his bullets are going. Come to find out, we didn't know. The front lines were behind us. We were laying out in front of the line between our lines and the Japanese lines. But I guess we weren't the only ones. So I said, "Earl, we got to get up out of here. We can't stay any longer." So we got up, and I had a mortar, and he had some rounds, and I had my rifle, and he had his. So we started, I don't know how we did, we finally found the company about 3:30 in the afternoon. And, hey, everybody was glad to see everybody else. And he said, and then my friend was a radio operator. Had a great big radio on his back with a big antenna. And he says, "I just got a call from the colonel." I said, "What happened?" He says, he wanted to talk to the company commander. And I told him the company commander had been wounded and was evacuated. And he says, "Well, just let me talk to any company officer." "Sir, we don't have any officers. They're all dead or wounded and evacuated." "Well, who's running the company?" "The top sergeant, sir." "Well, who's running the platoons?" "The sergeants." Oh, he said, he gulped. He said, here, gulped a little bit. He says, "What's your name?" "Sir, my name is Keith Kerr." "Yeah, I know you, Keith. I can remember inspections." He said, "Please don't get wounded. You're my only contact with the company," because they wouldn't let him in until the 24 hours. He said, "I want you, do you know where the front lines are?" "No, but I'll find them, Colonel." He says, "You go up there and tell the men to make a skirmish line. That's just line like this, one Marine, one facing the enemy." He said, "And then, right before it's dark, dig in. And when you dig in, expect a night attack." That's what Japanese like to do. They like to attack us in dark. So right before dark, we dug in. I was the last guy on the skirmish line. So I got my little shovel, and I was digging, and all of a sudden, blunk, blunk, and I put down there. Where I had to sleep, there was volcanic rock. Instead of having a nice, soft place to sleep, so I thought, well, there isn't any choice. You got to sleep here. So I went to sleep like this, maybe about, I suppose 9:30 or 10 o'clock. But before they did that, the sergeant got into a plastic bag, and he had a pen light, and he called. He went through the roll call, which is called 250 names. And one of the first names he called was Nichols. I said, "He's dead." "How do you know he's dead?" "Because he got his face blown off, Sergeant." And come down and got all the names. And he said, "Boys, we're in a lot of trouble. We have 99 men left out of 250. Now, not all were dead, but if they weren't dead, they were wounded and out on the hospital ship. So we dug in, and then we didn't have any attacks the first night. So he said, they decided they were just going to stay at the same place, just dig in until maybe we get some more replacements in, see? So we stayed there two or three days. We didn't move very far. And then we got some replacements, and there were young guys like us, and some of them had never been in combat. Some of them had never even been out of an office. That's when we had lady Marines, replaced all the males that were in the office job. They needed Marines badly to fight. So I got three sergeants in my squad. Hey, I'm a private first class. But there was no problem. They wanted to stay alive. So they come back about the third day or fourth day, and they says, we're going to move up in the morning, so be ready at the crack of dawn. So at the crack of dawn, our artillery starts firing. Bam, 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 bam. And I mean, they really fired a lot of rounds. And then after when artillery's done, you get up and you go towards the Japanese line. And we met very, very stiff resistance. And so, gosh, I don't suppose we went a few days, a few hundred yards. And the third day, it got dark. And he says, we don't have enough men to hold the front lines. L Company is going to come in here. You guys just start moving back. Well, we moved back to the rear, which was maybe 30 or 40 yards, and we just got settled. Boy, at least I get some rest tonight. All of them said the same thing, and I heard this radio. Weldon, take your squad and go back to the front lines. L Company does not have enough men to cover the lines. They had casualties bad also. So I took my one guy with me. Like the rest of them, I had him stay back there, and we went up. And we were with some Marines we didn't know. And it was rather a large, big hole, maybe about this deep. And it took 4 hours. And you could see, actually see the enemy out there. But they were just as smart. Don't shoot at them unless they shoot at us. Because if you don't, they can tell where we are. So we stayed up there, and I had a Marine with me who I didn't know. And I actually believed he was sort of afraid. I stood my watch and I said, Frog, it's time to come out and take watch. Take my watch. And he didn't come. I went back and finally, and I'm not proud of it. About the third time I went out, I had been on the watch, my shift, and an hour of his, and I just took my rifle and like this. I hooked it in his nose, and I said, you're coming out to watch. He says, my life is just as good as yours. So I made him go on watch, and the other two Marines who had been in there an hour that was sitting out with me, he said, well, your friend, he was shaking all over. He never would have come out unless you forced him to come out. And it made me feel bad, but later on, in 1946, I was living up on the north part of Champaign, and I went home one Saturday afternoon after work. And there's this truck sitting there, and it says, Iowa. I don't know anybody from Iowa. And I went around the corner of my house. Here was the guy, the same guy. Hey, my wife and I put him up. We fed him. He never mentioned what happened, and I never mentioned what happened because, hey, that was a long time, 1940. This was 46. And hey, a lot of guys died. It was so bad that the band was the burial detail. And they got so many dead Marines, they could not pick them up by hand, you know, carry them with a stretcher. They got trucks. One driving the truck, one guy up on top of the bodies, two guys pitching the bodies up. See, it was a health hazard. You couldn't leave the bodies out like that. No way. And the planes would go over and they spray DDT, all that stuff to keep the disease. And that was a terrible job. But they drove them back. The bulldozer made a nice path out, and there was a rabbi and a priest and a Protestant minister. They wrapped them in a poncho. They took their one dog tag out and said a nice prayer, and the bulldozer come along and bulldozed them. It was for health reasons, too.
That was all on which island?
That's all on Iwo. Hey. That was 6,000 Marines dead in 30 days. You know, people don't realize 6,000. When you leave the island, you look back and you see all those crosses. Hey, some of those are my friends. I didn't have time to visit the graveyard.
Yeah.
And then there was, Hey, there was 20,000 guys that were wounded. They couldn't fight. They had, I don't know, a big hospital ship and three hospital ships, small, you know. And one of the doctors who was on the ship, my friend was in the Navy, and he found it out, and he got permission to go see his doctor friend, Dr. Schoengert. And he was right down on 3rd Street and University Avenue. He was the head of the big hospital ship. And he said he had a nice visit with him. And after the war, that was still his doctor. And he says, Doc, you remember? Well, sure, I remember. You're the only guy from Champaign ever come over to see me. I was in that hospital ship. So every day we'd move up a little bit more, and we move up a little bit more, and we move up a little bit more. And all the time you incurred casualties. Mm-hmm. You just hope that it's your friend wouldn't get killed. So we come to a crossroad where we went back and got ammunition. So two guys would go back, because you'd carry, you have a vest like, and you couldn't carry too many because that volcanic ash come up over your shoe tops. Most of us were smart enough that we put leggings on. And otherwise the volcanic ash gets down in your shoes and socks, and hey, it'll cause sores. So I had this one place that we'd have to run. It was like a T, like this. And the Japanese owned that ground up there, and you didn't dare go back. It was all rock, and you couldn't see what was there, but you knew it was there. It was this great big, in the rock, had a big, two great big metal doors. And all of a sudden, these doors would open, and there'd be two machine guns. And they wounded a lot of our guys. So as we're going back, we ran across. They couldn't, once you get out of that line of fire, they couldn't go this way or that way. So I said, what are they going to do? He says, I heard by that, where are you guys going? I said, we're going to the front lines and get some ammo. As the time you get back here, that pillbox will be eliminated. So what do you mean? He said, they're going to bring a flamethrower tank up here. So the flamethrower, they couldn't see out. They opened these doors and fired and shut these doors, big metal door. And I come back, and there was a tank there, and you could, his barrel of flamethrower was just smoking. And I looked there, and there was four dead Japanese who were charcoaled. And their machine gun, it was so hot, the machine gun barrels were bent like that. So we didn't have any more casualties after they eliminate that. I don't know how many guys got wounded. So later on, I said to one of my friends, I said, Ed, would you take McHugh and go back and pick us up a little bit of ammo? Sure. But when he didn't come back, I got worried. You know, something's wrong. He wouldn't slap up. So about another 15 minutes, we're laying in this great big hole. Here he comes tumbling down. His name was Ed Boyle. I think it was Edmund. He was a devout Catholic. He was from Philly, he told me. And he come down there, and he was fair-skinned, and he said, puffing, what's the matter, Ed? He says, we got about 100 yards from here. And he says, the Japs started dropping some shells on us. And he says, we both dove on the ground. And he says, McHugh dove on top of me accidentally, you know. And he says, would you believe a shell hit him on the top of the head? And I felt so sorry for the guy, but because he had just joined us as a replacement. He had been in another battle, and he had a great big wound that was bandaged. They told him, you can go back, McHugh. The 4th Division will take care of you. So he got his... he got his second Purple Heart, and that was his last Purple Heart. So I looked at Ed, and we had metal helmets on and camouflage covers. And I said, Ed, would you give me your helmet, please? My helmet? Yes, just give me your helmet. And I turned around where he couldn't see me, and I wiped his helmet clean in the ash. The other man's brain cells were on the helmet. He didn't know it. He'll never know it today. But I'm telling you this because this is actually the way it happens. So we get near we got 2 days, and we can see the end of the island, and the battle is over, and hey, we haven't got very many guys left. And we couldn't get any replacements. And we get ready to go to bed, and I look up about 30 yards, and there's three Marines up there who are not in our company. I don't know them. But you all band together at night, and they put these rocks, and they had one was two young guys like me, and one man, I heard him talking, and he sounded like a Kentuckian or a Tennessean. He must have been 37, 38 years old. And I woke up during the night. I was standing watching. You couldn't hardly stay awake after 20 days. You know, you keep nodding off. And I looked up, and I saw in that hole, smoking, all three. I can see the cigarettes. You can smoke all right, but you got to get down where nobody sees it, see? And I thought, my God, I hope nobody sees it. And there's a tremendous drop off in their hole, maybe about 20 or 30 feet. It's all rock. An American could never climb that. We didn't have the right kind of shoes. And I leaned back just like this, and all of a sudden, there's a tremendous explosion. And I can see fire and stones, and I can hear screams. And a Jap climbed up there and tossed some grenades in with him. And hey, it was terrible. So you don't move around at night on battle. So we had put some parachute flares that we put, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. We couldn't move these guys until daybreak. And so we got to them and put the flares up. And one Marine lost his heel and he was all full of shrapnel all over. But we gave him, the corpsman gave him morphine. And the other Marine, he got a lot of that too, some burns maybe. But when we got to the older man, it's bad. He must have set on the grenade, and it just blew part of his hip away. His hip bone was sticking out. I asked him if he's in a lot of pain. Yes. Give him two shots of morphine. What difference does it make? So when the daybreak come, we carried him down to the ambulance jeep, with just a little jeep, two stretchers at a time, with two guys can haul the jeep. So I'm carrying this one guy who I didn't know, and he says, "What's your name?" I said, "My name's Sam." He says, "You know, Sam," he says, "I'm so glad to get off the island." He says, "Even if I'm wounded like this," he says, "I'm getting off alive. I was afraid I was going to get killed." So when we got to the last gentleman, the older man, I was 20, 37 was old then. And we tried to move him. And all this muscle and tissue that held the hip in place wasn't there. And he let out a scream like I couldn't be. I said, "Look, give him some more morphine." And we got a piece of plywood underneath of him. And we picked him up. And Corman, we taped his leg so it wouldn't hurt. Got him back and got him in. And I often wondered how the orthopedic doctors repaired him. But there was no damage to the hip. It was just getting some tissue, you know. And we're standing around. It was just getting light. And I look down in this hole, and I can't believe what I see. These people were wounded and laying. They was laying four grenades laying there that didn't explode. Hey, every guy was standing around like I was, and carrying the corpsman. It killed everyone. So that really shook us up. So we moved up a little bit, and we could look out. We could see the end of the island. And say, boy, there's some caves out there. And pretty soon I hear this radio coming. "Weldon, take your squad and rescue Bolton. He's laying out in the front lines. He's been wounded." Oh, criminy. Here we got one. So there wasn't a minute's hesitation. I pick up a stretcher, let's go. And I grab my three guys and myself, and there was a bunch of rocks, 6 or 8 feet tall, about three bunch of them. You go over, and so we go over the first bunch of rocks, and the Japanese start shooting at us. And we get down to the bottom, we get down behind the rock, and this one guy says, Sam, I don't want to die. Hey, I said, "I don't want to die either. Just give me a minute." I'm thinking, I said, I'm thinking to myself, how can we do this without getting all shot? So we skirted around these rest of these rocks, and we get down where we can run, and we run down. It's about 100 yards. Hey, four of us are running with a stretcher, and you can't believe the terrain. Rocks and boulders and holes and stuff. and we finally got down to my friend and opened the stretcher, put him on it, and to carry a stretcher on level ground is hard, but carry him on rocks, and he's bouncing up and down, and finally we got him out of the line of fire, and we laid the stretcher down, and his name was Jim Bolton, and he was a machine gunner. What he was doing, we were going to move up and do our thing, and the battle would be over. But he had a pistol tied to his hand, and a bunch of Marines down about 100 or 200 mistook him for a Jap, and they started shooting at him. And as he went down, hey, he has the pistol, he hits a rock, and he falls, and he shoots himself in the groin. And I says, "Jim, are you hurting?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Just a minute." I found a dead Marine, and I went in his gas mask. Everybody had a gas mask with serotonin. So I opened the morphine up and gave him a jab in the butt, took some of his blood, put a great big M there, and I asked one of the guys, "Now look, there's an ambulance jeep coming up here. Would you stay with him until the corpsman team or the doctor?" "Yeah." So the ambulance jeep, we got Jim on there. And when the guy didn't come back that I sent with him, it's just like something always happens. So the guy come back in about 2 or 3 hours, and I says, "What happened?" He says, "Well, we get back to the first aid station, and the Navy had decided that there wasn't enough wounded, so they moved the main station, first aid station, down to the front lines." And he says, "When I got there, there was 24 Marines laying on the ground." And he says, "Two corpsmen and one doctor." So they treated the worst wounds first, and his was the second worst, you know. So they gave him a shot and morphine right away. They shipped him off and took him down on a small boat after when they got him to the beach, and they out to a hospital ship and made some minor surgery. And he was he went to Saipan or Tinian, where they had an Army or a Navy hospital, and they did some more. And then they flew him to Treasure Island in California, and then they flew him to Great Lakes. And there was two Marines in a room at Great Lakes. That's the way it was. That was the rules. So my friend Jim lay there, and a man come in to visit his son. And they were talking, and he looked down at his name, and he says, "What'd you say your name was?" And the gentleman says, "My name's Welton. Have you got a relative that's got a real short haircut?" And the Marines, he said, "Yeah." He says, "He and his squad saved my life. And when they operated, they took him out to Great Lakes and they operated him so he was able to father children." That was the concern about him, see. And I got a letter from him. Hey, I was single, and I remember getting it, and he thanked me so much for what he did. And I could never find the letter. And I could never find his address. I could never find a phone number. My boy lives in care. How many people I called trying to find Jim, how he was doing. But that was just one thing, you know. So
did you get medals for that? Other things
no.
You did?
To get a medal, you have to have a witness. And your witness has to be somebody who's fair or an officer who's unbiased. We didn't have.
No officers?
No officers. They were all dead or wounded. The company commander who got wounded, 3 weeks later or 2 weeks later maybe, he has all the shrapnel dug out of him, and he volunteered to come back. You have to keep books. The guy's number, you know, yep. Did so-and-so die, you know? A lot of paperwork. And now he did all the paperwork. He couldn't fight, loaded with a lot of shrapnel, see? So as we walk out that day, he says to one of my friends, you know, he says, "I don't know if you guys know it or not. Well, what, there's one road goes back to the ocean where we get on our ship." He says, "We got 34 guys left back there, the original, and that's all." And he says, "Wouldn't it be so nice?" So we go back to the ship. We get on a ship. We take our sea bags, which is laid out there on the beach. I still have my uniform. My mom saved it at home, packed away, and uniform. And we got back. The captain of the ship says, "Now I'm going to tell you. Everybody takes off all their clothes and put a great big cardboard box, throw all your clothes in there, everything but your shoes and your helmet." And then they come along and they sprayed you with DDT. You know, DDT is a cancer causing agency. So then they said, "Now, all of a sudden, somebody had a shell in their rifle, and it goes bang, and it bounces off all the walls, and there's all these Marines down on the ground with no clothes on, see? And he says, hey, all you squad leader, you inspect every rifle. The Navy captain, boy, he was mad, because here you come all through that battle, you could kill somebody accidentally. So we checked all the rifles, and they sprayed us, and then we run in and got a hot shower, and they gave us all clean clothes, clean underwear, clean socks, clean dungarees, you know. Hey, but they warned you. It says, now, guys, when you eat, you can eat all you want. But if you eat too much food, I'm going to tell you, you're going to spend a lot of time on the bathroom. You're going to have diarrhea because you haven't had any good food for 30 days. And so I heard a lot of screaming the first night we was on the ship. I had a nightmare. I dreamt that they were trying to attack us, and there's a guy next to me, and he carried a great big automatic rifle, and he had shoelaces tied it up like that. And during the night when I had this, I reached over and I grabbed his rifle, and it was comfort to me. It's like a hungry man eating food. And I got up the next morning, he says, he's a little guy. He must have weighed 130 pounds, carrying this big rifle. He says, you had a bad time, didn't you? I said, I had a terrible. He says, you reefed over, and he says, you grabbed my rifle. He saw everything. I said, aren't you going to come to breakfast? He says, no, I ain't been asleep all night, and I'm not sleepy. So we went to eat, and we come back, and finally he went to sleep. He slept the whole day. We didn't even wake him up. He could figure he could eat anytime he wants. So I didn't tell you one story that I'd like to tell you. My friend, his name was Charles Miller, and Charles from Carbondale, and he's about 5 years older than I am. He's been gone about 10 years, died on a golf course in Florida. Charlie got wounded on Saipan. He got shot through the shoulder. He got hit before they could rescue him. He got shot through this, another big hole. He said he woke up 3 days later in the hospital ship, and the corpsman was changing his dressing. And he says his shoulder hurt so bad, and he couldn't understand how a little Japanese bullet like that would hurt so bad. Well, he had a pistol, a holster back here. He would never be taken alive. And during the firefight, a Japanese bullet hit this thing and exploded. It became a bomb. And he says when that corpsman turned around and had a full-length mirror, he says, what is my shoulder? And the corpsman said, I'll tell you why. And he turned him around. He said, I could have put my hand in that wound on my shoulder. And he said, it took about 6 weeks. So this happened before. I wasn't with him in that battle. But he was on Iwo Jima, and he was commissioned. One of the sergeants was a lieutenant. And he says, Sam, right in those last 20 days, he says, they sent me in a young kid. He was a corpsman. And he had no business being a corpsman. And he looked around, and he says, his eyes were this big, and he was just shaking. He said, now, kid, I'm going to tell you something. You sit right by this tree stump here, and if we get any wounded, I'll go with you and cover you. And Charlie says, you understand? Yeah, yeah. So Charlie said, I'm laying in this little hole right next to this bell like this. And he says, not having any sleep, he said, I dozed off. And he said, I was awakened by a blood-curdling scream. I looked up, and out of one of the holes in the ground, here comes a Japanese officer. He's bringing a sword down on my head. He said, I raised my rifle up like this and blocked the thing. It hit his fingers and his rifle. And he said, I rolled him over, and he said, I had a knife right back here, and I just put him away. And he said, hadn't been for that young kid, Sam, he said, I'd been dead. He said, of course, they evacuated him. You can't have any kind of wounds because of infection. He got off. And then as I saw him on a reunion in St. Louis, and I hadn't seen him all. That was been in the 80s. I hadn't seen him since the war. Charlie, let me ask you something. What did you do after? Well, I got a degree. I got married. I was a teacher. I was a superintendent. And then I got called back to the Korean War. You told me never to volunteer on this. It was a good outfit, but you just bought. He says, I didn't have any choice. I was in reserves. So what happened in Korea? a boulder fell off a small hill and hit me the small of the back. And I fell, and I laid there in all the mud. And he says, there was no Marine first aid. It was all Army. So they had to get an Army guy. And he's laying there, the small of the back, bad injury. He got frostbite on the inside of his thighs. They took him into the operating tent, and this doctor says, got his records. And he says, Charlie, we're going to discharge you. We don't need your body anymore. It's beat up. You've had wounds here, wounds there, wounds here, and now you got this bad back and you got frostbite. How much more punishment do you think your body's going to take? And he shook his hand. Good luck, Charlie. And Charlie says, on the hospital. By the time he got back to the United States on a hospital ship, he was in pretty good shape. He was, you know, hurt in here. But I saw him, and he was a great golfer. He loved to golf. And just like Bing Crosby, he had a heart attack on the golf course. No better way.
Well, now, you were a private when you went in, and you were what
yeah,
when
private,
you came out?
Then, hey, if you go through your basic, you get to be a private first class. Then after that, if you get promoted, you're just lucky. And the only reason I got promoted, somebody got killed. It was just that simple, because my friend and I, they'd always give you a test. Would you like to be a leader? No. Do you want to be command? No. What do you want to do? We want to go we want to go home. And the officer read it. He knew us. He said, boy, you guys will never get promoted. Well, no, I did. We did. And I got promoted. My friend got killed. And my friend, when he got killed on the beach, later on, they said he was missing in action. Well, we landed at low tide. They go around, check all the wounded, and the battle's terrible, they check them all, make sure they're dead. We don't do anything about it because you got to make it stay in there. So what happened, like a lot of them, the tide come in, and his body floated out to sea. I know. I had to go back and write a statement to his folks. I think the name is not important. I think he was from Texas.
So you could verify.
Yeah. But they have a missing in action. When they have missing in action, the parents get his pay for another 12 months. And, you know, one of the days we go get ammo, and we had a guy with us. He was a Syrian. And he had something to do. He was from Chicago. He was little and he was noisy. He knew a lot about rugs. Syrians make rugs. So he didn't keep up with us. He walked away, and I said, stay up with us now, rug beater. And we get down, and the Japanese had a mortar about as big as my body up. But they couldn't guide it very well. And sometimes it went over the island into the ocean. But when it hit, it was like having an earthquake. The earth would move like this. Now, as we got down, after the first one went off, I hollered, it's hard in battle to reach her. But everybody get down. They're going to fire another shell. They usually fire two. And sure enough, they fired another one. And I get up, and here's my friend standing up like this. And I'm looking at him, and he's spitting blood. I knew that he didn't hear me. He got a wound in it. I said, you guys got to take Rogers down to the first. I always remember his name, L.E. Rogers from Kansas. You don't see him. I never knew what his first name. L.E., that was it. So they were able to walk him down, but I'm sure that he lost a lung. And then when we got back, got our ammo, and all of a sudden we're missing a man. I said, hey, we're missing rug beater. And I says, remember the last time that shell went off about 100 yards down there? I thought I saw him there, but, you know, you lose track. Will you guys go down there and get some of those Marines that are in the foxholes? Ask them to help you. We got to find out if he got killed or if he's not there. So those Marines helped him. When they come back, the guys gave me, there was a $5 bill and a piece of a shoe with a serial number on it. But it was a Marine serial number. There was no blood. There was no tissue, no uniform, no nothing. So he got a direct hit. And that way he was listed as missing in action. And his folks won't get back in the day. The insurance policy was $10,000. And his folks got his monthly salary for a year, and then the $10,000. But, you know, it's a merciful way to die rather than to die suffer. I mean, he never knew what hit him. So on the way back, we had a lot of, we never saw, I don't think, the war was so advanced that when we were on Iwo, they needed that thing because the big bombers were leaving from Saipan and Tinian, and if they were flying over Japan and they got shot up, they have to ditch their airplane. And if they did that, they had lost the airplane, they lost the crewman. So we figure out how many, by the time the war was over, how many of those planes landed on Iwo Jima. There were three airstrips. One was going, and our Seabees, they did a wonderful job too. They finished those airstrips so a big plane could come in there and land. As a matter of fact, before the battle was over, the guy said he couldn't get any fuel, and he didn't have enough gasoline. So he landed. When he landed, it was a terrible land. Bounce, bounce, but it didn't wreck anything. And there was an Air Force guy, jumped in there real fast, and there was a valve stuck. And he was able to unstick the valve, told the guy, now you're getting gasoline. The gauge come right up, and he says, turn the plane around, go home. Wow. So we figured all the planes that landed there and counted them by the number of men, we saved at least 20,000 guys from going into the drink, plus the planes.
So where did, so you were on Iwo, and then you went where?
After that, well, hey, we went back to.
I mean, did they give you R&R?
Yeah, we went back to Maui.
Okay.
And on nice troop ship, and we got back there, and they gave us R&R. They usually don't bother you too much. You know, for a week or 10 days. You don't have to shave. You don't have to make your bed up. You don't want to. They know what it is. So they gave us 4 or 5 days over in Maui. And when we got over there, another guy found a nice Japanese or Oriental place to stay. It was screened in porches, and we slept outside. You know, I had a cover on. And then we'd go down to the restaurants, and we found a place where, of all, we could get a glass of beer. And I found a place where I get a glass of beer and some fried shrimp. I was dying for shrimp. My folks were in the seafood business. I wanted shrimp, but I couldn't get it. So after the thing was over, we went back. They come and get us in a ship and take us back to Maui. And, of course, you could never tell any of your parents, grandparents, aunt and uncles where you were. But you could say, I saw Jim the last couple of days. I'd write to my mother. That was my brother-in-law. Well, he wasn't my brother-in-law then. But so my mother would call and tell his mother that we were together for a few days, see? And we went in one time and ate at the Marine. This was submarine headquarters. All the subs in the Pacific come back from their runs, and they had 30 days off. Hey, they didn't shave. They looked like a bunch of animals, but they didn't care. That was the submarine service. And the food was excellent they had. And the Navy got the best coffee. You can have coffee 24 hours a day in the Navy. They always got fresh coffee. Oh, I love that. I love coffee. My grandmother was a German, and she always had coffee. And I guess drank coffee ever since I was 5 years old. So when the war was over, there was a lot of guys that had been overseas 40 months, 38 months. You know, had families. So they had more points, and they got to go home. The division got to go back to Los Angeles, what was left. And they come and they said, you're going to China. I thought, listen, I was 20 years old. I was not married. I know I could see China. That would be my only chance. I'd never get another chance. So they put us on this. The name of the ship was the Bomb Home Richard, the good ship Richard. It was a small aircraft, and it was converted for troop ships. The flight deck was open, and the hangar deck where they kept the planes, we had our bunks. They were all bolted down there, and happened to be full moon, the nights we were on the ocean, and it was the most beautiful trip. They didn't put the sides up. You could see, and I see these dolphin swimming with the ship, and they swim miles and miles and miles. You wonder how far a dolphin. He says they can swim hundreds of miles. They think it's fun. They get close to the ship's bow, dump in like that. So we're out to sea, I guess, about 3 or 4 days. And all of a sudden, I noticed the engine stop, and I hear the anchor go down, the anchor chain. One of the guys said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I don't know what we're doing. I don't like it." I said, "The anchor's down." Here's it. They call our names. Report to the top of the flight deck. Well, I knew something was changed right away. Just like we used to say, Marine, always changing orders. And we're civilians, you know what I mean? So up on the flight deck, the guy had one of the tables like that, a sergeant, and he said, "What's your name?" "Weldon." "You're getting off here." Well, I looked around. I said, "This is not China." He says, "I know it's not China. You're getting off here. This is Guam." Well, they had given us a bunch of cold weather gear, long johns, heavy boots, jackets, hoods. So I just took all the clothes out of my sea bag and threw them on deck. Somebody else can take these. Another Marine, they kept some on to go to China. So I got on there, and we got in there, and a captain met us at the dock. Really a nice gentleman. And he looks at all the names and all the... "Well, guys," he says, "you guys are nothing but a bunch of infantrymen. All of you are on Iwo Jima, right? Does that make us bad?" "No, that don't make it bad." But he says, "This is an MP outfit. You'll have to get used to it." He says, "When you get in there, you can put your weapon away. You have to carry a .45, and you have to drive this Jeep through the jungles. You take turns." He says, "Your 8-hour shift 1 week, another 8 hours, 24 hours a day you drove that. Even at night you went through the jungles." There was Japanese there, but they never bothered. They were just survivors, you know. And he says, "You got a guy that's driving, that rides shotgun. And also, if you see any Navy vehicles in the village, you run them out." They didn't want the Navy men in there with the Native women because they had Native boyfriends and it caused trouble, see? Oh, they would really get mad and we'd make them come out and go back to their base. We never did anything to them. And so we were there from September, and I think in March, they said, "You guys are going to go home." And we had fresh milk, we had fresh eggs, they had everything out in the Pacific that we never had in Hawaii, because that was Admiral Nemesis' headquarters. And when he drew his rations, he got everything. We had steak once in a while, never knew what steak was. And matter of fact, we had trouble getting Spam sometimes. So anyway, we got on the ship, and it was loaded for bear. You couldn't get another Marine on there. It was in March, last part of March. No, I'm sorry, it was April. So we went to Treasure Island, and we unloaded there, and everybody wanted to get out right away and go outside. Never been out to drink, never seen a lady, you know. Nah, I can wait. Go out the next morning. So I went out the next night. Three of us went out. I guess we went out and had a big dinner. And there was a beautiful, beautiful bar at the top of Mark Hopkins Hotel. It was called the Top of the Mark. It was called, you could see all the battleships, everything floating in the harbor, and as the sun was setting. So three of us, we started drinking. I don't know what time it was. We started about 7 o'clock. We never stopped drinking until 5 o'clock the next morning. So we celebrated our first night in the United States. We went back, and a day later, they put us on a troop train. And they shipped us across the country to the Great Lakes. And we processed there, and I got discharged on April the 21st, 1946.
And the war was over?
The war was over. Oh, yes, it was over. See, I had to stay long. When the war was over, a lot of guys got out. But if you were younger, you had a point system, which is okay. That's the way it should have been. And as I got out, it was a cold. I remember it was a cold, cold Easter. Hey, Great Lakes was cold. And first thing we all did, we had these Marine top coats. They were heavy wool things that you never wore anyway. We put all of those, and we jumped on the North Shore train took us down to Cubs ballpark. And we got off Cubs ballpark, all three of us, carrying sea bags. That's all we owned is the clothes in there. My grandmother and aunt lived 10 blocks from there. And we walked down there, and my in-laws are all German. Hey, they had food there, and they had whiskey, and they had wine, and they had the neighbors. And when you wore a Marine uniform in Chicago, you never bought a drink. You couldn't buy a drink. They refused your money. Most of these places where we weren't, we're working men, get off work, yeah. You know, policemen, firemen, really nice people. And after about 3 days, I got a call from my mother, wanting to know when I was coming home. Mom, I said, I'll be home tomorrow night, and don't worry. I said, we're just having a nice time. And these two young Marines with me, they were my age. They were from the East Coast. So my grandmother and aunt had enough. They had plenty of sleeping area and plenty of food. And we would come back, and my aunt would say, look at their eyes. Look at their eyes. Chuck, that was my uncle, you making these guys drink. Hey, Julia, I said, they didn't make us drink. We're just looking for a place to drink. So the other two guys, I bid them farewell. I never saw them again. And I went home that night. And when I got home at the station downtown, there was about six or seven of my high school buddies waiting for me there, and they had been in the service.
We got to take a break. I got like 30 seconds left on this tape.
Okay.
Okay.
So. Did you make them?
Okay.
So as the train met me, my mother, my father, and there was my best friend's sister was there. Hey, when I went away, you know, I was 18. I think she was 15 or 16. And lo and behold, she told my mother, Viola, I'm going to marry your son. And I thought, I knew my mother. And I'll bet that didn't go over very well. A 20-year-old son just get home, and here's a young, pretty young girl said, I'm going to marry. And you know, we did get married. And we had three children. She died about 10 years ago. And when she said that, my mom never told me, but my wife told me later. I said, I'll bet that went over big. But she became, my mother never had any girls, just two boys. And she became a daughter to her. She took my mother to the doctor or took her shopping, all the things that she never, you know, never could do with the daughter. And her mother is in the nursing home down in Sullivan. She's be 102 in February. She had five children, and she outlived all but two.
Wow.
And I wouldn't give $1 million for my experience, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody what happened to me. And you know, when I went into service, the day I left, I had to get somebody to hold my mother. She says, I know you're going to get hurt. I know you're going to get hurt. She says, you got your finger caught in a shotgun, and you got shot in the leg, and a rifle blew up and hit you in the mouth. All those things happened to me by the time I was 14 and 16. And it wasn't drinking or drugs or anything like that. It just happened, you know. I accepted them. And when that first shell hit on Iwo Jima and I got fine air, I thought about what my mother said when I was up in the air. Something is going to happen to you. So, you know, I didn't get wounded. I've got bad ears. But it's much, much, much better to have bad ears than no sight or no legs or no arms or anything like that. And so many young guys did that. And as we sailed away from Iwo, I looked back on this troop ship, and I could see all those white crosses. There were 6,000 crosses. And what they did, 6 or 8 years later, they came back and they exhumed all the bodies. And some of the bodies they were unable to identify. They were blown up so bad, or they didn't have any dog tags, or say. And those, they buried them someplace under unknown, you know, in a Navy or a graveyard. There's a national graveyard over in Danville. And it's unfortunate. It got so bad, we usually have a reunion. They just had a reunion down in our Marine reunion, a division reunion, and down in Louisville. But my friends were so old, they didn't go anymore. They couldn't travel. And anybody was in my company, like, there was not a soul the last time I went. So it was just, hey, we went to, the last reunion I went to was San Antonio, Texas. Beautiful, beautiful hotel. But once again, my wife was with me then. And a lot of good experience, a lot of good friends I made in the service. But the unfortunate thing was most young guys, not married, no responsibility. You should have wrote your names, address, and all your friends in a book, see? But the war come on and ended, and bingo, everybody wants to get home or get where you're going, get rid of this. And our camp was on a plateau, and sometimes you'd reach out your tent, and there would be clouds coming down the street. That's how high up we were. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained in that camp. I bet it rained 16 inches a year down in the town of Waluka, was their main town on Maui. I got acquainted with a lady there. It's an older lady. She was in her 50s back there, and she liked young Marines. She'd kid a kid joke with her. How much does it rain down here? Maybe 2 inches a year. And yet it was still green down there, see? And this volcano, of course, was inactive. And so I asked a guy one day who went to Maui, what is there where the camp used to be? Well, they leveled it, and the government had to put it in back shape. They leased this ground. And subdivisions, now they have homes up there. And he said, you would never recognize the place. It was like going to Guam. Guam had, when I got there, had everything in it. They had McDonald's and A&W. Guam is a stopping off place for married Japanese. That was where they honeymooned because it's real close. It's nice beaches.
So none of those places have burial grounds?
No. If now I don't never heard of a, or perhaps of a man dying over there. I did hear one, and of course you never think, what are they? He was from Illinois. There's a military explosive that you still use today. It's like a piece of putty. Mm-hmm. And you take it, and you take a pencil, make a hole into it. You put a primer cap in it. You put the fuse in it. Hey, and you can crimp it around, and you can blow it, put it over there, and it'll blow up anything. But you do not force the cap. And we were down in maneuvers in Maui, and one time, and I heard this terrible explosion, and the ambulance come down. The young guy just forgot, and he was doing this. He forced the cap, and that's why I wondered how they probably buried him in Maui, you know, because they had no way to. I had burial at sea, you know. That's another thing. There's no way to keep anybody when you're at sea. You put him in a body bag, and you tie shell casings, and you play taps, and salute him. You render his body to the sea, and that would be, to me, very terrible for the folks. You don't have your boy. It's not closure. You know, you never have closure. But most of the guys who went in the Marine Corps realize what they're getting into, and when they go in today, they know what they're getting into. I feel sorry for their mothers and their fathers and their relatives. But that's what they want to be. Hey, if something had happened to me, I wouldn't begrudge anybody. So when you see a man go into the Marine Corps, a young man, the worst thing, he's going to get killed. The next thing is going to get maimed. The next thing he's going to get maybe get a light wound or a flesh wound. My cousin had to, it was on Saipan. A piece of shrapnel went through a tank, went through his elbow, and that's the one that ended up in Great Lakes. And I think he had 7 operations, and he had a short arm the rest of his life. But he finished college, and He got a real good job with State Farm. He was a junior executive. They took him, shipped him out someplace in Connecticut, which was a nice place to raise a family. And then the last 2 or 3 years, he came back. They were from Northwood. And the last exit on the interstate, my wife died in 97, and she had cancer, and he called her and talked to her, and he says, "We deserve better than this," tell my wife, both of them. And I said, "That's the truth. You do, both." So he had a big military funeral, had bagpipes, and that's what he wanted. So my brother and I went up to the funeral, and my brother was driving. And the funeral was, hey, with all those small towns up there, subdivisions, we got lost. We didn't get back to the family home for 1 hour. I said, tell your relatives that your farmer friend from Champaign got lost on the graveyard.
But if you summed up all of your experience, could you sum it up? Was it worth it?
Yes. Hey, if I was 18 today, and there was a war on, that would be the same thing. I'd do the same thing. To me, it was the hardest and the toughest and the meanest, and yet, when you get done, you know, just like a guy called me a year and a half ago, and he says, "Hey, how would you like to join the Marine Corps League?" I said, "Fine. Meet me out to the VFW." And I went out there, and I saw 20 guys, some younger, a lady Marine. She's got to be 65. And really, she was in the BAM. It's called, that's what they call the Marine, BAMs. And she's active in it. And we've got a couple of guys who were wounded. And matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, I had a funeral. This man wanted some Marines to be at his casket. It wasn't 5 minutes, it was all done again. And he was an ex-Marine, so we just did that as a favor. And they have a color guard. If they request a Marine color guard, we got Marines that do that. And they got uniforms and everything. Trouble is, I'm getting so old, I can't hardly remember the meeting night.
Is there something to add, or do you think we've covered
Pardon?
It? Do you think we've covered it? Or
I think we've covered just about okay. all of it. I hope we didn't scare anybody off that wants to go into the Marines.
I don't think so. Cool. Okay.
So is there anything we do to sum it up or anything? You just, his summary was kind of a good ending.
Really good, yeah.